call 800-686-2237. That's 800-686-2237.
Our terrorist cells are prime terror targets located near you. Where are military bases and hazardous waste sites located? How do you find the best area for solar, average rainfalls, fish contamination advisories, and major transportation routes? In the new interactive CD book, Prudent Places USA, you will find the information you want with over 50 interactive parameters that you control. Find everything from housing prices and taxes to brewing environmental catastrophes. Locate billion-dollar disaster-prone areas, the safest cities, ideal solar locations, and much, much more. Complete with over 3 gigabytes of detailed information on each of the 3,000 plus counties in the U.S., including 550.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, hopefully for the next hour they're going to be the views of our good friend Dr. Joe Douglas. And Joe worked with military and military intelligence for many years, lives back in Washington, D.C., knows a lot of people there. He's written a book on red cocaine. And, of course, the communist involvement in the cocaine industry, the worldwide. But also, he acknowledges readily the CIA involvement in this. In fact, what most people don't understand is that communism has been simply a foil, financed and maintained by American forces, American bankers, American corporations, with the help of our Federal Reserve System. You had to have an enemy so you could rally the people behind the government. And so we maintained the communist regime. In fact, we were there at the time. Our people were back there at the time the war was created. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, I tell you a story based upon material I found when I went through Colonel House's paper back at Yale University in 1980, and immediately after the Second World War, of course, they had the Communist Revolution, and you had Lenin talking about overthrowing capitalism, and certainly the Prime Minister of France was a man named Clemenceau, and the Prime Minister of Italy was a man named Orlando. Both of them wanted to send military forces into China, into Russia, to put down the communists. And Colonel House, of course, who was deeply involved in the occult, he was the man who really controlled Woodrow Wilson. He was Woodrow Wilson's occult handler. And I don't think Wilson was a bad man, but he didn't realize how evil this little man was who was his best friend. And Colonel House writes in his diary, and I have his diary. They've suppressed it for many years, but I got a copy of it. That's a long story. Colonel House writes in his diary how he convinced Clemenceau that there was no way that the French or the Allies could put down the communists in Russia. And then he convinced Orlando, the Prime Minister of Italy, that there was no way the Allies could put down the Soviet regime. And then he went on to say, but I knew what I'd convinced them of wasn't true. I knew there was a battalion, regular troops and of artillery we could put down the communists very readily. But I didn't want Clemenceau and Orlando to know that. Why? Well, he doesn't say, but of course it all has to do with you needed an enemy. And communism was a convenient enemy to focus the attention of the of people on, and basically was the people working in our country, the very wealthy people who kept organizing the anti-communist organizations. And I'll admit that I fell into their trap for many years. And they financed anti-communism so that we would not realize that the real enemy to our country, the real reason that Russia had gone communist, that Eastern Europe went communist after the Second World War, and that China went communist after the Second World War, and that Cuba went communist, and Nicaragua went communist, and Rhodesia went communist, and that South America is under communist regime was very, very simply because our State Department brought communism to those countries, solidifying tyrannies throughout the world. Because, of course, they all want to have a one-world government. And every government has to be brought under control, because if there's any country that is not under control, then they'll never be able to have their universal world government. Well, we've got Joe Douglas on the line here. Joe, thank you so very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment, as soon as we have our break, and we'll be, of course, having a new audience. We'll bring on some other additional stations. And then, of course, we'll have Dr. Joe Douglas talk to us a little bit about how the banks are, working and helping the criminal element. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is Dr. Joe Douglas. And we were going to talk this afternoon about the bank's involvement and the criminal elements and how they use banking throughout the world. Dr. Douglas has worked with the government and intelligence for many years, and he's retired now, and there's written a number of books. Red Cocaine, certainly one of my favorite ones. Betrayed is another excellent book going into the background of the men that were abandoned by our government, knowingly left to rot and die in the communist prisons and camps over in Vietnam and in Laos. And they knew about it, and it's really a heartrending story about the men we abandoned in Korea, 8,000 of them, about the men we abandoned during the First World War, 25,000 of them, about the men we abandoned after the First World War. But we never talk about those things. Those things are totally suppressed in America, although we do have a Senate report on that, if anybody wants to read it. But, of course, you'll never find this ever mentioned. Well, Joe, you pick up the story there.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. You know, to really get a handle on this organized crime in the banks, I think that the one has to go back several years to when Nikita Khrushchev took over the Soviet Union, because he is really key to this whole story and what has happened, which has made the banks the problem they are today. What happened when he took over is he immediately modernized their whole strategy for conquest. And besides working on the military side, he worked on what turned out to be the first real focused operation in what we would call a non-traditional warfare, or non-military warfare, if you will. And what he did is he formed three operations. There were key operations. One was on organized crime. The second was international narcotics trafficking. And the third was international terrorism. And these three were the way that he was really going to win the war without fighting. Now, when you look at those, they all require money and money laundering as key components. In addition, what is key is elements of corruption, particularly among the political elite and the banking and the legal area and the law enforcement, right on down the line. And then to protect it all, you bring in duplicity and deception in large measure. The main component, however, money laundering, was essential to all three. And that's true when you go back even way beyond the Soviet Union when it was formed to very early days in crime. You always had the banks involved with organized crime, because that's where the money was, and that's...
Hold that thought. Just a moment. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this afternoon, Dr. Joe Douglas, who's certainly been a researcher for many years back in Washington, D.C., and certainly he was talking about how already one of the biggest problems for America came when Khrushchev took power as the dictator of Russia, and this probably would have been in the late 50s, late 50s or early 60s, and he laid out basically a plan where they were going to be able to use a criminal element to undermine America, and of course they were going to get involved in financing terrorism, and they were going to be financing criminal activities. But you pick up the story from there, Joe.
Yeah, it really started around 1955 when he had taken control, and as we mentioned, the big banks were really essential because of their ability to work in money laundering. Now, what Khrushchev did when he took over these three operations, didn't take him over, he really identified them as new strategic intelligence operations that were going to be a major strategic importance. What is important here is that he turned what had been previously sort of mom-and-pop operations, ethnic operations, what have you, into large state businesses managed within the KGB, their intelligence service, which is probably the best, the largest, and most capable that has ever existed in the world. And so they became very large, and the banks were actually part of the operation, integral to it, and actually worked to design the money laundering aspect. In about 7 or 8 years, they got to a point where they were getting so much money in from the organized crime and the narcotics trafficking that they had to completely reorganize the money laundering. And that was done by two groups working in parallel. Number one, the KGB, and number two, international finance. They worked together with the international finance, identifying the banks, even the people within the banks, and intelligence doing the security checks on the people. So you had this whole thing that was building up very quickly in a totally new approach to organized crime and narcotics trafficking, which was a major state business operation.
But I think most people would find it very difficult to believe that the communist intelligence organizations would be working with our banks, and yet, of course, apparently this is what's happened.
Oh, absolutely. You know, they designed the money laundering, and then a curious thing happened. That it was so important that in 1964, the Soviet infiltration of the banks, penetration into the banks around the world, became the third highest priority on their intelligence espionage ladder. They put that much emphasis on it. And so you're talking about thousands of infiltrations, perhaps tens of thousands of infiltrations over the next 10 years or so, so that they had people in banks everywhere. Because the banks were so critical to these global operations to have their effect on the citizenry and on the political systems, and to basically fight this indirect war, as I mentioned before. So it was the banks were really in there from the start. They were a key component. They made a lot of money. And they weren't communists per se that I can see necessarily. They really didn't sort of have any allegiance or close ties to anything other than money. Money was their god. And it's like, I think it was David Rockefeller that said in the late or mid-70s one time that he really didn't care what the political climate was of the country so long as they paid the interest on their loans, in effect. And that was sort of their philosophy. And the more money there was available, the better. My source that was part of the operation had also explained, for example, that in working with the top leaders at some of the German banks, they would tell them that, their enemy wasn't communism. Their enemy was Chase Manhattan Bank, who they were in competition with. And they really didn't care, another quote was, they really didn't care where the drugs came from or where they went so long as they got their cut of the profits. And this was the attitude of the people in the big banks. Now, the other thing that comes in here very strong is when you've got this much money, it's criminal, it's illegal, you have a tremendous amount of corruption that's going to take place. In fact, when the Soviets really started setting up their agents out to first penetrate existing organized crime and narcotic trafficking groups around the globe, they had sort of two missions. One was to get in the organization and learn how it operated. And the second was to develop lists of all the people who had been corrupted by the business so that those lists of corrupted names became a blackmail list that they could use in then controlling, exerting strategic behind-the-scenes control of the entire operation. And that's how they did that. Now, as an idea of how effective that was, Czechoslovakia, in working in the narcotics trafficking area, in about 5 years after it commenced in 1960, they had dossiers on people of influence and power that numbered 3,500. And they had a lot more files than that that applied to people of lesser lights at that time. And these were all people who had been corrupted one way or another by the drug trade. And it was, of course, not only Czechoslovakia, but you also had East Germany, Hungary, Poland, Soviet Union, Bulgaria, all of those were major players.
And of course,
the Soviets developing way over 10,000 lists of people that they could use in a blackmail sense as agents of influence.
Now, you were really getting this information from this Czech general that you knew, General Senya?
Yes, I was.
Right.
Now, General Senya, for all the people that are listening, is the highest-ranking defector we have ever had. He's the only one who is actually a member of the decision-making hierarchy in Czechoslovakia. He was the secretary to the highest-ranking decision-making body, the Defense Council. He was chief of staff to the Minister of Defense. He was a member of half a dozen different groups that gave the marching instructions to the main political administration, to the parliament, to the Central Committee, of which he was also a member. But he was right at the top. He had a tremendous memory, too. He interacted on a person-to-person basis with people like Khrushchev, Brezhnev, Suslov, Ponomaryov, Grechko, Ustinov, Yepyshev. These were all people that he knew, that he attended meetings with, and all of the meetings that were on the formation and the planning of the organized crime, the terrorism, the narcotics trafficking. He was there. He was present. He knew who was there. He remembered exactly what they said. He had such a tremendous memory. So it was really a fascinating time with him to listen to all this pour out, all the manner in which they were planning, how they looked at narcotics trafficking. Actually, the objective of narcotics trafficking, for example, was to corrupt the youth, because those are the people most susceptible to it. Once they get over the age of 25, they're not susceptible, so you want to get them when they're young, in the youth.
And because
the idea was to weaken them, make them so that they would become weak leaders in the future.
And, of course, the thing is that here in America, of course, they're using our youth in the gangs, creating a sense of lawlessness, and, of course, they're into drugs, drug selling, making a lot of money that way, and into crime. And of course, the illicit drug sales are such a large part of the crime here in the United States, which is why today there are 7 million Americans either in prison, probation, or parole. And, of course, 1 in 3 young black men between 21 and 31 in prison.
That's right. And, you know, those gangs were actually planned, a lot of them, by the Soviets, and they recruited a lot of people from the Caribbean, particularly Caribbean blacks. And then they trained them in Cuba along with the Hispanics, and then they were smuggled into the United States through mainly through the Mexican border. And this took place basically in about the late 60s and early 70s. And that's when a lot of the real vicious gangs became involved with drugs and moving the drugs and distributing them across the country. And that's another thing that nobody recognizes is the role of the Soviet Union in training people for these operations. You know, they always stayed in the background. They made sure that they weren't seen, because this was part of their plan. You know, they had to hide these operations so people would recognize what was happening, and that would end their effectiveness. So they stayed in the background and did the training, and it was the front people that did the operations. That's why they had, one of the reasons they had these training facilities that were set up in all of the communist countries and in the Soviet Union, and they would bring people in that they recruited from the indigenous countries. There were indigenous people in the countries, citizens there, preferably without any type of a jail record of jail term or things that would put people on the watch out for them. And they would bring them in for 2-week schools, at which time they became, you know, trained and educated and professional drug traffickers or organized crime elements. Then they would go back and they would start their own operations or work their way into existing operations that they would then later become prominent in as other people got killed off. So it was quite an operation. And the corruption, as we were talking about, it was mammoth in terms of the number of people that were involved.
Well, I mean, certainly people in our government had to know what was going on. Certainly our Central Intelligence Agency had all of these things infiltrated. They had to realize what was happening.
If, in a sense, they didn't know what was happening, at least a certain amount of them, one would have a hard time explaining why they treated General Senya so poorly and debriefed him for a whole year with never talking about any strategically significant topic.
Maybe they didn't want him to tell them what they didn't want to him, what they didn't want to be have anyone know that they already knew. I mean, certainly these people could not have been so inept unintentionally.
Absolutely true, and they didn't want anybody else looking at that that way too. Of course, this brings in another field which is critical to here to this. And that is the whole suppression of information on the crimes of the communists, which was true not only in our country, but also in Europe as well.
Isn't it amazing? We never talk about the 41 to 43 million Chinese that they intentionally starved to death between 58 and 61. Why don't we ever talk about that? We talk about the Holocaust, the Germans, and the 6 million Jews. Why don't we ever talk about the 41 to 44 million communists who were starved to death? Because I remember, I was getting started in this whole thing back in 1960, and it wasn't until just a few years ago I ever heard about the Great Hunger. But then I suppose when you have a nation with freedom of the press, means, of course, when you own the press, you have the freedom to suppress whatever you want to. Go right ahead, Joe.
You know, you bring up an excellent point there. We look at the Holocaust, Dr. Stan, but we don't look at the crimes of communism. If you recall, there's a book published, a very well-known, very respected book, The Black Book of Communism, back in 1998 or 99. And this was a book that was produced by half a dozen French scholars who were also themselves former communists or close fellow travelers, as the editor pointed out. And one of the first things they did is they took a look at the Holocaust, and they then said, well, you know, it's very understandable why the Holocaust got such an attention. But on the same hand, why is there such a silence from the academics? Why such a silence from the politicians about the crimes of communism, which were far worse than anything that Hitler ever committed, and they applied to two-thirds of humanity for 80 years? What they were really hitting the nail on the head there was this silence about the crimes of communism. No one was allowed to speak about it. You weren't allowed to talk badly about the communists. One of my good friends, when I heard that, he said, gosh, you know, I remember listening to President Nixon in 1969 when he'd just been elected. And somebody asked him if he was going to take on the communists, the Soviets, I guess. And his response was, me? No, I would never say anything that would bring any type of annoyance to the Soviets.
And yet he got a start in politics by, you know, being one of the major people who was exposing Alger Hiss and his communist background. It's amazing how people will use communism and then when they may be able to do something effective, back away.
Absolutely. Once they get up and they learn that you can't speak badly about them, they change their tune. They see the wind is blowing from a different direction when they get high enough in the power structure. Now, one of the things that really brings home what is happening here, there's two things. You know, and I want to go through organized crime a little bit with you, Dr. Stan, and then look at the size of the money involved. It's just amazing because it tells you, it really makes this whole crime thing come alive and what's happening. In 2000, there was an interagency, U.S. interagency study, and they produced what they called an international crime threat assessment. And this is a global study, and the conclusions that they reached apply to the whole world, and that includes the United States. There's nothing that's said in the thing that this doesn't apply to the United States, and most of us that have looked at the problem know that the United States is the largest money laundering country in the world, and they certainly do. Let me just read you a couple of the quotes. These are direct quotes that I just cut out of here. Number one, most organized crime groups have been enormously successful in their illegal ventures because they have successfully corrupted those persons charged with investigating and prosecuting them. Another one, illicit proceeds are used to finance political campaigns, buy votes, protect their operations, influence legislation, gain insider access, and preempt prosecutions. Another one. This is a U.S. report. It's on the Internet. Lawyers in the criminal's pay have used detailed knowledge of the law to manipulate the judicial system and to influence law enforcement legislation to protect criminal interests in countries around the world. major trend in organized crime is its legalization and elite manipulation and use of the law to further their special interests. Another one.
Hold that thought, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Douglas is just talking about really how the criminal element has been using the American banks with their knowledge to launder massive amounts of drug funds. And, of course, these funds are used for all sorts of illicit purposes, and some of them, I suspect, even funnel back into certain black operations of our own government that we cannot let the American people know about. But you pick up the story there.
Okay, let me finish a couple of these quotes here. International criminals are attracted to global finance and trade. Now, this is one of the reasons behind the New World Order. It facilitates all this.
Basically, of course, what is this report that you're reading from?
This is the United States International Crime Threat Assessment Study.
And it was put out, actually, by a special division of the government trying
to... It was a multi-agency effort done in the year 2000, and the report is dated December, I believe it's 17th, year 2000, with this title... International Crime Threat Assessment. It's about a half inch thick. It's wonderful to read. They did a wonderful job. It's unfortunate they didn't really focus a lot of attention on the United States, but everything they say applies to all the countries.
Here's the thing is that there are good reports out there, but the average person will never hear about them, will never read about them, and certainly the media as a whole will never let the American people know about these extensive reports that are coming out all the time showing already some of the subterfuge going on at the highest levels of our government. Go right ahead.
Yeah, and you know, this one passage here really lays out the real interest here behind free trade and the New World Order. Listen to this one. International criminals are attracted to global finance and trade. They're able to avoid scrutiny because of the importance to businesses and governments of facilitating commercial and financial transactions. Now, let's take a look at a couple of ways, one other thing here on the banks. You know, in 1984, I believe it was, he was right at that period of time, and there was a guy by the name of Rodriguez, who was a top money launderer for the Medellin cartel down in Colombia, and he was arrested with $5.3 million in cash leaving their country. And as they talked to him, he basically explained how the banks all courted him, the money launderer, so that they could get his business. And he named a lot of banks. He named Citibank, Citigroup, the Bank of America, the First National Bank of Boston. And to confirm that, there was another special by ABC that was put out the same time, about 1983, which it looked at drugs and money laundering, and they started naming a lot of banks that were involved, including Citibank, Marine Midland, Chase Manhattan, now J.P. Morgan Chase, Irving Trust. You know, they were involved with all the big banks because there was so much money. If you just look at the narcotics trafficking in the United States, and you forget the usual government publicity and the amount of money, by the agencies that are involved, they estimated at about $50 billion a year in the 1985 time frame. By the 1990s, it was up to $150 billion by several people that were looking at it, including The Economist. And by the late 90s, it was over $200 billion. Now, you can't have a business that's that large without the active participation of all the big banks, because you got, you know, $200 billion that you're going to move around and hiding. You can't do that by yourself. You know, you and I can't do that kind of stuff. But this is the way in which the banks are organized. Now, there's a book that came out that really lays out the size of the money in a beautiful way. It's a book that was published by the and study was done and published by I believe the Washington International Economic Institute. And the name of the book is Chasing Dirty Money. And what they did is they were able to get data in about 21 countries. So they just looked at those 21 countries. And those were most of Europe, Scandinavia, New Zealand, Japan, the United States, Canada, and Britain. These are the only ones really given the access, is what it boiled down to. They calculated that the underground economy, this is the money laundering operations, in 2001 was roughly $3.5 trillion. And I just extrapolated that using the growth curve that they also printed in there and figured out that if you're talking about it today, then you're talking about at least $5 trillion. And not only that, but when you look at the countries that weren't examined, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, Russia and Eastern Europe, Israel, Middle East, Africa, all the major money laundering offshore islands, China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Latin America. These are all laundering money areas. And if you start including that, you're talking about an annual money laundering operation. Just money laundering. Of $10 trillion, possibly as much as $20 trillion a year. Mammoth amounts of money, and the bankers' take on laundering that money is between 15 and 20%.
And, of course, where is the money? That's the question. Who's got it? We're going to be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Douglas is just talking about it's as much as 10 or 15 or $20 trillion that's being laundered throughout the world at the present time. And, of course, who's ending up with all this money, Joe?
Well, I was just reading a report, an article last night. It was on the banking problem we're having at present and the mortgage money. And one of the things they said is one of the sources of the problem of the mortgage money was that there was so much money available, cheap money, and that's the one thing that started pouring. What do you do with it? You know, pour it into mortgages. What a wonderful idea. Now, a friend of mine who was in the mortgage business about 4 years ago, he got disgusted with the way in which things were going in the mortgage area, and he started looking at it because he thought that this was being used as a way of laundering money. And he checked with a few of his friends in the banking area, and a couple of them thought the same thing, but they didn't want to talk about it. So where's all the money? Well, that's one place, because you got to launder it. And you had a lot of money going through there. That may be what really led to all this expansion in derivatives and what have you. Now, there's another place. If you look at the banks, you know, there was a very interesting bank that came out in the late 1990s. It's a bank in Luxembourg, and it had the name of Sedell International. It's later been changed as it merged with a German stock transfer house. But there's a book that was written by a guy who was a computer expert and who worked for Sedell designing the whole computerized systems for their keeping tracks of accounts. And then after the big Italian scandals and a few murders, he got let go because, as they said, he knew too much about the operation. And after thinking about it for a while, he decided to write a book on it. And he did. And it really identified this bank as, well, it was just a major money laundering operation right in the heart of the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg. Money laundering, tax evasion machine looked by, as he wrote here, used by major banks, shell companies, and organized crime all over the world.
Okay, hold that thought, Joe. We're going to be back in just a moment as we pull up our other stations on in here. And I think it's so vitally important that people understand that there is criminal activity and many of our major banks are involved in it, and nothing is ever done about it. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this afternoon, Dr. Joe Douglas, author of Red Cocaine. We carry his book, Betrayed. He's coming up with a new book very soon, but we're talking about the bank's involvement in criminal activity, and our biggest banks are laundering money, but and the government knows about it, and the intelligence agencies know about it, but nothing is done. Oh, occasionally they get a slap on the wrist, and if you or I were to do anything, why, we'd be in prison, but these people don't go to prison. When was the last time remember a banker going to prison, for him being involved with illicit activities? Usually, of course, they get promoted. They become like Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury. And here's a man who made almost $1 billion working as a banker. And then he tries to pass himself off as just a bumbling idiot. Oh, shucks, I didn't know what to do when I got the TARP funds, and I changed my mind. And so I gave it to the bank so they'd loan. But I forgot to tell them they had to loan the money. Oh, so my goodness, nothing has gotten any better as 4 months has gone by, and no money's been loaned out, and the whole economy's coming down. And ladies and gentlemen, it's all showbiz, all smoke and mirrors. But we're talking about the involvement of the banks with illicit activities and with money laundering, and of course it takes us right into organized crime and drugs. Pick up the story there, Joe.
You know, as we think about this money, go back to this one quotation out of the International Crime Threat Assessment study. It's just beautiful. It says, illicit proceeds are used to finance political campaigns, buy votes, protect their operations, influence legislation, gain insider access, and preempt prosecutions. And they have all the cash that they need to do that. Unlimited when you think of an operation each year is just laundering, the amount of money they're just laundering totals $10 to $20 trillion, a lot of money. Now, talking about, the suppression of investigation, there was an investigation launched in the Sedell International, and eventually they found them perfectly innocent. After one of their people was on the inside, identified what they were doing. And this first struck my attention, why I got interested in it, was there was a little tiny piece of paper in the article in the Wall Street Journal one day that talked about, an offering and a little PR thing on Sedell, I think it was. It might have been Clearstream, the successor. But it said, here was a bank and its advertised assets were $7 trillion. And that stopped me. $7 trillion assets under management? Well, that's a big operation. And, of course, they were a clearinghouse for banks around the world, including the biggest banks around the United States as well. And I contacted a friend of mine, the banking that had links into banking in London there, and he said, he confirmed the number, and his British professional said, but they would have estimated it more like $14
million. $14 million or $14 trillion?
$14 trillion.
$14 trillion. And I have to understand that these banks, I remember one time I went back and spent a weekend with General Albert Wedemeyer, who was a four-star military general, fascinating. A couple of weekends I spent with him, but visiting him at that time was a Belgian prince. And, of course, Prince Royalty, but where did he work? Why, he worked in Belgian banks. Of course, that's where the money is. That's where the royalty, they call them the black nobility. From generation to generation, they're involved in these nebulous activities. But go right ahead.
Yeah. Well, this turned out that this difference between the $7 trillion and the $14 trillion was taken care of in some stuff that Backus, who was this guy that worked there that wrote the book, because he explained that they, in the mid-80s, they went into private bank accounts, not just public ones that banks would use, but also private accounts that were secret. And he said by the mid-1990s, they had over 3,000 accounts in these secret private accounts, and that they were equivalent in size to the public size of the bank. So that's the difference between the $7 trillion, and what the British estimated the total assets under management were, which was twice that, or $14 trillion, which is how the difference came about. So it tracks with this other story. And, again, on the problem of the elitist sticking together and avoiding prosecution when you got this kind of money. In 1998 or thereabouts, there was an announcement report in a London paper, a couple of them. There were five large, prominent London law firms that were being investigated and who were basically operating on behalf of organized crime and drug cartels and laundering money for them. And we tried to follow that, but it, within a month of it being out in the public press, it disappeared. Nothing again was heard of it. And it all quieted up, all put back to bed, and nobody knew about it. A few people died in the process. And the same thing with the bank, the investigation of this bank in Luxembourg. Big splash. There was a book written about it and came out in France. It was totally suppressed in all the other countries there. It received almost no publicity in France, and within a year, you couldn't find it any place.
And, of course, it's so difficult for people to believe that books are actually suppressed, but they actually are. We know of a number of books that I've come in contact that have been actively suppressed, and because they do not want the American people to know. We're carrying a book called, Target Patton, the story of the murder of General Patton. It's already available over in Europe. Lots of front page coverage on the newspapers about it. Not a word in the American media about this book, Target Patton, about the government's effort to kill one of our greatest American generals. So, and certainly these things dealing with finance are just, they're so unbelievable. In fact, recently, a reason I read 5 or 6 newspapers every day is because once in a while they have to print the truth. Hearing about Bill Clinton's, he has a foundation, a private foundation he established, after he left the presidency. That foundation over the last 8 years has raised $492 million, almost a half a billion dollars, $492 million. That's over and above the $110 million that he and Hillary have gotten for their income, but the other $492 million goes to the foundation. Why are people giving these vast sums of money? Because Bill Clinton is such an honest, moral individual? I mean, Barack Obama got over $700 million for his campaign, and I don't know how many tens of millions went into his inauguration. I know that the Rockefellers gave, I think, about $375,000, to his inauguration. You and I can't give that sort of money to a political candidate, but the elite can. And of course, it all goes under for services rendered. Go right ahead.
Yeah, now, when you bring in the connection of the Soviet Union, or more properly, Russia, now you're stepping on everybody's toes. And hence, you need to maintain a terrific silence over these things, and that means the last person in the world you want talking, or you want anybody getting interested in, is somebody like Sanna. Even though nobody knew him, he was just an unknown in the Czech hierarchy, he was well known over there, but over here, no, he didn't get any publicity, he didn't speak English, and he was kept in the shadows because he was a top guy that knew what was happening.
Now, because you actually spent, how long debriefing him, 6 months, a year?
Try 15.
15 months? And if there's what you
15
think
of years.
15 years.
I worked with him 15 years off and on, and written so far about three books on it. And it worked out very well because before he defected, before it was introduced to him, I had been spending about 4 years digging into the Soviet literature to understand how their thinking was and their ideology and military planning and threat assessment, all this sort of stuff. And when I first started and I requested documents from the intelligence community, it takes about 6 months to get them back to me. In the meantime, I started reading some translations of Soviet material, the Russian material, only things that were internal documents used by the general staff for the education of its officers or the political party, all internal type of things. And then when the intelligence started arriving from up the street, I started reading the things. I was doing a study on Europe, and the intelligence reports started coming in. I started reading them, and I said, this is garbage. A, it didn't make sense. B, it just reflected what would be nice from a U.S. policy point of view. And C, it did not correspond with the Soviet thinking, which was tremendously advanced beyond ours in those areas, because they were not thinking of deterrence, in which the mere presence of weapons is what deters, but they were thinking of war fighting and war winning. And nobody wanted to hear anything like that being done by anybody over here. And so it never reflected, it was reflected in the literature. But when I started reading the stuff and saw the difference between the two, I decided, well, I was going to continue the work I was doing, but I was not going to get contaminated by anything that wasn't just 100% Russian and internally intended, not Pravda or Izvestia type of papers. So I worked that way, and so by the time I got introduced to Sena one day and attended a briefing of his and then chatted a little with him on the side, we had a very good rapport because I knew what he was talking about and it made sense to me, and I was interested in what he had to say. And then a little later, I was asked if I could use him again because the CIA wanted to get rid of him at that time. And so I said, well, you know, let me find some work. So I found some work. And I said, sure. You know. And so I started working with him then. After I started writing up some of the material that we were talking about, I was debriefing him on, suddenly all my funding got cut off. Interesting. When I worked with him, it became clear that he had never been debriefed in the first year that he was here. All they did is they debriefed him on make-work objects, like they had him spend 2 weeks one time drawing officers' insignia from memory, which he could do, but he commented to them, why bother? I mean, you can walk across the street from your embassy in Prague into the library and you take the drawings, are a lot better than I can draw, and ridiculous things like that. And that really piqued my curiosity, and that's when I started really listening to him and learning it, which was fascinating. And, of course, he was on the inside of and at the top level of all these various operations we've been talking about here. And so fascinating things that he had to say about the banks that really encapsulate the whole thing in a way. This was when they were really expanding in the organized crime and the narcotics trafficking. And Czechoslovakia, which was the closest satellite to the Soviet Union, was heavily involved. They were probably the most trusted of all the satellites and the ones that were involved right from the beginning in many of these operations and played a key role in them. And he said, with respect to the international finance, he said, never was there a decision made in Moscow that international finance was not present.
Would you repeat that once more for our guests? Never was it made a major decision made in Moscow where international finance was not present?
That's correct.
And I think that's really so vitally important that listeners understand that there is an interrelationship between international finance and this so-called world communist conspiracy. In fact, who's funding it, who's directing it, and well, of course, that gets into Professor Sutton's work and
sure
some
does.
Of the things we've written as well. But go right ahead, Joe.
Yeah, and that goes back to what is said in many of the reports that you have there and other people have written about the only people that could really walk in and talk to the head of the Kremlin at any time was somebody from the big banks. Everybody else had to walk or stay and wait in a line or schedule something, but them, no, they could walk right in. That goes right from the day that Lenin first took charge, with examples that Sutton has in his book of that. And the second thing he said, now he was saying that one of his jobs as Secretary of the Defense Council was to maintain scheduling control over a whole group of secret villas that were all cleared and were used for places to house special dignitaries for sensitive meetings that were taking place in Prague all the time, particularly between Soviet people and other people, because the other people didn't want to be seen in Moscow, and the Soviets always like a reason to get away to Prague away from Moscow. And another thing, so he knew what he was talking about on these things, and he said that never was there a week went by that there were not meetings, secret meetings with top leaders of international finance in the villas in Prague with people from the KGB and Czech STB. So they were over there working, and they would go to Prague where it wouldn't look like they were over in Moscow and do their thing there. And, of course, one of the additional things that the Soviets relied upon heavily with people like the Czechs, Hungarians, and the Germans a little bit later, Bulgarians, and they relied on them because they knew that people on the outside didn't trust the Russians. They hated them because they were just sons of bitches. And you can go into that in never-ending stories about how bad they were. But the reason they used the other satellites is because the other satellites were not viewed that way by the outside world. So the Czechs or the Germans or Bulgarians, what have you, could infiltrate, make friends with, and penetrate organizations around the world, particularly organized crime and international narcotics trafficking, governments, social organizations, all of them, with ease. And then they could identify people, recruit them, and once they had them under their thumb, then the Soviets could step in and take control. And that's the way they operated in large measure. And that's why they met in, had a lot of their meetings in Prague in the secret villas that were, that when that happened, Sena knew they were happening because he scheduled them and he always watched over them to make sure that they were being properly supplied with everything they needed and were happy. And I thought, he wrote out top reports on all these activities and officially so he knew what was happening. And one of his jobs was to arrange the entire schedule, agenda of the Defense Council and then see what came to them, organize it for their interest, interaction, and decision, and then write up all the decisions and then distribute the results to all the people in the top of the Czech government. So he knew everything that was happening there.
And because I think what's really so fascinating is the close relationship between international finance and communism. And until people begin to see how this all begins to fit together, there obviously is some sort of an X factor. And I know for many years, as I was analyzing it, I kept scratching my head and saying, none of this makes sense. I've got all these facts. I've got all these dots out there. But there's got to be something else. And, of course, only eventually do you begin to understand the true implications of the Brotherhood of Darkness. Right ahead, Joe. Hold on. We'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up today's program right here at Radio Liberty. Joe, do you have any sort of a website or anything you'd like to get out?
No, I really don't.
All right.
Dr. Stan, it takes the steady work to keep one of those up, and I've never had the time to do that.
Well, fortunately, I have my son is able to do that for me. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a website either, but he does a great job, so go right ahead.
He sure does. Well, it has been a fantastic time working with General Sena, and he opened my eyes tremendously to these things, and when he did, you could see the dots being connected. It's very interesting in that regard. In the late 70s, about two or three people, very unusual what happened here, they all started working with Sena to learn about terrorism. And he knew all about it because he was of all the planning. And so they spent a long time, and they got the whole strategic perspective on it from him. And then they decided to... they knew they couldn't use it in any meeting with the CIA because the CIA hated his guts. And so they proceeded to search the intelligence database that they had access to, and they were able to confirm everything that Sena said using CIA reports and NSA and collateral. So they put together the whole story, eliminated Sena's stuff completely, and turned it into his special national intelligence assessment that was being developed. And the person that was in charge of it from the CIA was mad as a wet hen. He demanded to see all the reports, and the three people from DIA wouldn't give them to him, but they gave him a list of them. And at the next meeting, the head of this meeting proceeded to discredit all of his own agency's reports in order to kill what the DIA was saying, which was precisely what Sena had told them, except using the CIA material. And the guy from DIA, the lead guy there, he stood up to salvage things, and he looked over at the NSA guy, and he said, how about you, NSA? Do you also discredit your information? The NSA guy stood up, he says, no, sir, we stand by all our data. And so the data found that it at least got into the report as a footnote, but it was that the major lead sponsor of international terrorism was indeed the Soviet Union.
All right, Father. We're out of time, but Joe, I want to thank you so very much for being with us and look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Oh, it'll be super time. Enjoy it, Dr. Stan.
Thank you so very much for being with us. And our guest has been Dr. Joe Douglas, who spent many years of researching and intelligence back there in Washington, D.C. And God bless. We'll talk to you later.
Look forward to it, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Douglas is simply giving us a lot of the background of what certainly the relationship between communism and international terrorism and communism and crime. But let me tell you that the CIA worked very, very closely with, of course, the Soviets. You're not supposed to know that. You're supposed to think there's this great cleft between them and one is plotting against the other and one agents are trying to track the other agents. But I actually had in my home one of the leading central intelligence agencies, a fellow named Gunther Rusbacher, and I interviewed him, and we spent quite a bit of time together. And as he was telling me the relationship between the CIA and the KGB, I said, well, that sounds just like the book Brotherhood of the Rose. It actually had basically a docudrama on television with Robert Mitchum, The Brotherhood of the Rose. And Gunther looked at me and he said, that's my story. I gave the information for that story. In fact, the book is dedicated to me. Well, of course, whenever I'm dealing with people, you know, with intelligence, I'm always very skeptical. The next day I was down buying a copy of The Brotherhood of the Rose, and you can get it, and you'll find in the dedication the reference to, and a special thanks to my good friend Russ for the information he put out. And, of course, Russ was the nickname Gunther Rusbacher. You can look him up on the Internet. There's a great deal of information up there on Gunther. Fabulous individual. What a real privilege it was to spend time with him. And, of course, to talk to Joe Douglas, who's certainly been researching this, all of these matters for many, many years. So you have to understand nothing as it appears to be. If you'd like to know how the United States financed communism from inception, Professor Sutton's excellent book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, second book he wrote on the subject, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. My interview with Professor Sutton called The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. It's available on DVD. And then, of course, my pamphlet on the Communist-Capitalist Alliance. You need to have this information. You need to know that nothing is as it appears to be. And if you wonder about how Adolf Hitler was able to start in the beer halls of Munich, get elected in 1933, and he wasn't even elected chancellor, he was just elected, and then that pressure was put on Hindenburg to actually go ahead and make Hitler the chancellor. Why, of course, you need to get Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. We don't carry the book Funding the Enemy. I think it's Trading with the Enemy by Charles Hingham, but the book you can probably get on the Internet, at Amazon, but Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler is probably the best book. The American corporations, the American banks funded Adolf Hitler, not only before the war, but during the Second World War when they were killing our boys. You will never hear this sort of thing through regular channels. We are always greeting the best enemies money could buy. Why? Because wars bring havoc and horror and terror and murder and bleed and suffering, and there really are people who want this sort of thing. That's why you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's why you need to hear my talk on the Forbidden Secret and get the syllabus that goes with that. And that's why you need to get our latest DVD. It's called The Eye of the Phoenix. It's very professionally done by our good friend Chris Pinto. And it goes into the emblems on the back of the dollar bill. They love to hide their emblems in plain sight, knowing that the average individual is incapable of understanding them, or even if they understand them, they can't believe it could be so flagrant. If you read the book written by Manly P. Hall, who is a Satanist, called The Secret Teachings of All Ages, and you can order that through our website, but it's not on our list. You'll have to remember the title, The Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly P. Hall. And then we carry that book as well as much of his other writings, The Lost Keys of Freemasonry, where he talks about the relationship of Masonry and Luciferianism and then The Secret Destiny of America, where he tells you about the emblem on the back of the dollar bill and of course, America's secret destiny is to lead the entire world into a one world government. Understand these things not imaginary and number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com, where you can listen to our programs on the internet 9 hours a day. And then please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.